Welcome to the Middle East Reforged Special Edition. I'm John Riley. Each week, I help you make sense of what's happening in that region through a biblical lens. Security threats, archaeological discoveries, biblical prophecy, those are just a few of the things that we cover each and every week. And the main purpose of the Middle East Report is to encourage you to read, study, and apply the Word of God in your life. And the best way to do that is to connect to the people, places, and geography of what we read in the Bible. And I help you do that each and every day here on the Middle East Report. And today, I am coming to you from Israel, in the northern part of Israel, where there is a lot of conflict happening right now. And we have the awesome privilege of talking to somebody who is in the IDF, that's the Israel Defense Forces, Major Yaakov Sullivan. And I'm so thankful to be here with you because we are going to get an update on what's going on in Israel. We're going to talk about Gaza and so much more. Welcome. Tell us a little bit about what you do with the IDF. You are a major in the Israeli Defense Forces, and tell us a little bit about what your mission is and what you're doing.
So I drafted to the IDF 17 years ago exactly. I served in compulsory service for 10 years, started as a tank driver, went along to being a commander, a company leader commanding 11 tanks. I'm a graduate of the IDF Tactical Command College, which would be the equivalent to the United States Military Academy of West Point, which I work with every year when there's no war. And I officially finished my service 7 years ago, but you know, in Israel, everyone is still a soldier. So I, for the last 7 years, have been serving in the same unit I did all of my service. It's called the 188 Armored Brigade, a tank unit located in the Golan Heights, where we're speaking at right now. And I'm the unit's COO, Combat Operations Officer. A Combat Operations Officer basically views everything happening in the battlefield. And then there is a tank, a company leader, a battalion commander who has 30 tanks in the front line. He doesn't see the full picture. He has a very narrow view of the battlefield. And I have the privilege of overwatching him from above and then connecting him to the Air Force, to drones, to cyber, giving him a better intelligence picture, helping him with the logistics. And we'll talk about what happened, what I've done in Gaza the last 4 months. But for example, he has an injured soldier, unfortunately, who was killed. He needs to evacuate him back to the border. Someone has to do all the coordination. That's my job. I have 15 soldiers and officers under me. And then October 7 comes, and I find myself, you know, coming to synagogue, and I'm an observant Jew. Right outside of the synagogue, I walk inside. One of the rabbis catches me and says, you know, a war began down south. I said, what do you mean? I said, they kidnapped a soldier? He said, a lot of them. I said, what, they came through a tunnel? He said, also. I said, what, they came from the sea? He said, also, they came from the air? He said, everything you can imagine is happening down south. So I ran home, I turned on my phone. No one expected a war. Called my commander quickly. Turns out they were looking for me. It turned out that already at 6:47 a.m., 45 minutes before the IDF officially declared a war broke out, the commander of the 188 declared war on WhatsApp. He wrote everyone, war, go down south. And maybe I'll take a moment to pause, John, for a moment and say that just to understand the atmosphere in Israel the days before. When I say in Israel, it's especially in the Israeli Defense Forces and in the Golan Heights where I live and serve. We were commemorating 50 years to the Yom Kippur War. In the Yom Kippur War, the Syrians attacked the Golan, invaded, but they were slowed down by heroic soldiers from the 188, my unit and others, who were able to stop them in certain places and slow them down in others. Not one Israeli town was conquered. There was time to evacuate the women and children. And the reservists came, and after 72 hours, the whole Golan Heights was back under Israeli control. Now, this was a national trauma. The intelligence picture was so obvious, and we missed on it. We have the best intelligence in the Middle East, so if they want to do something, we have the ability, technological tools to warn ourselves, and we'll be able to hold back the Syrians until the reservists come, and then we'll go to a counterattack. This is a national trauma for 50 years. And October, the first week of October, the Golan was filled. Hundreds of thousands of people came. The Israeli government invested millions in preserving different battle sites. I hosted the Minister of Defense on a few days before the war broke out. on the border with Syria on one of the battle sites. And I was told by his office, you have 12 minutes to give him a briefing of the battle that happened on that site. And I said to him, listen, we have only 12 minutes. Let's not waste our time on talking about the failure, the intelligence failure, because I think we've already learned our lesson. We don't underestimate our enemies. And so maybe I'll take 11 and a half minutes I have left. Let's talk about the battle that happened there on the person level, the soldiers. I didn't understand what I'm saying. 3 days later, we understood we haven't learned anything. We haven't learned anything. Now, just to understand, because the week and the year before was all dedicated to studying the Yom Kippur War of 73, it was deep in the state of mind of all the soldiers. So the words my commander chooses when he wants to make sure everyone understands we're in war, he says, Yom Kippur has happened again. Take everything you have and go down south. And the difference between 73 and 23, 50 years and one day, is that here in the Golan, there was an understanding we're going to a battle. No one understood it's going to be a huge war. But when the war starts on October 6, 1973, a few minutes before 2 p.m., the soldiers are in their tanks ready to go. They're alert, they're sharp, and they're able, because they're much better than the Syrians, they're able to stop them or slow them down. On October 7, the conception was so much worse that the line was neglected. Half of the soldiers were on vacation. Here, after 6-7 minutes, you already had dozens of Hamas fighters in Israel. We're talking about more than 5 Israeli towns conquered by Hamas, more than a dozen of military bases conquered by Hamas. This is not even, Hamas is not an army, a terrorist organization, a terrorist army, was able in many hours to fully control Israeli towns, fully control military bases, massacre, rape, behead, and there was no army. The 188, most of our tanks were located here in the Golan Heights, and the soldiers were deployed around the country. One of our commanders took, without permission, without authorization, he took 20 tanks before the war, a few months before. He said, everyone's focused on the north. We all understood, but talk about it. We're going to war this year in the north. And he said, maybe something's going to happen in the south. So he left his tanks down south. Those 20 tanks were the first tanks to enter the Israeli towns and bases on October 7. A tank is a game changer. And so the tanks of the 188, 50 years and one day after, they were defending and holding on to the line here, hoping for the others to come and save the day. 50 years and one day later, they were the ones to come and save the day. And that was the game changer. Every town that I came to and I spoke with people who were in the battle here, they said it was till the tanks came and after the tanks came. And we were there. We were there since October 7, more than 4 months.
We're talking to Major Yaakov Sullivan. He is with the IDF. He's in the reserves. And in the news, you know, you're hearing a lot about, you know, no humanitarian support or not enough humanitarian support coming into Gaza. You're hearing a lot about the amount of casualties. You served in Gaza. What did you experience firsthand, especially regarding humanitarian support? Because the narrative out there right now is, well, not enough humanitarian support is coming in. What did you see or what did you experience there? What are we not hearing in the news that we need to be hearing?
I think the first and most important thing that people are missing out on is there is no such thing as uninvolved people in Gaza. Let's go to October 7, and maybe I'll quote Hamas spokesperson. When there was audio and visual proof of beheading Israeli babies, raping Israeli women, Hamas spokesman says, it wasn't our fighters, that was a mistake. Our fighters only killed soldiers. The people of Gaza did it, because the border was more than 20 places broken through. And what happened was the Hamas sent out messages to all the people, you can come in. And so part of the massacre on October 7 was Hamas terrorist with their cruelty. I don't believe Hamas spokesman, he's a liar, but I do take what he's going to say. We saw so-called innocent civilians raping, stealing, killing, kidnapping. They're not uninvolved. There are armed terrorists and there are unarmed terrorists. Does that mean I go inside and kill babies? No. Does that mean I go inside looking to kill everyone I see? No. But the conception must change. Hamas was elected by the people of Gaza, is deeply supported by the people of Gaza. Every second house I was in Gaza, not just me, all of our soldiers, we found materials of Hamas. We saw support. I can show you photos on my phone of kindergartens full of different games that show mines and bombs and guns. I can show you pictures of how they show the Jews as, you know, pure anti-Semitism. We're fighting the Hamas Gaza terrorist state. As Jews and as people who view themselves as part of the Western democracy, we have our ethics. Our ethics come from our DNA. Not from PR, not about what is the world going to say about me. Now, I personally saw humanitarian aid. I personally took part in operations that allowed the elderly, the women, to leave the regions we're in. And it needs to be pointed out, they're holding hostages, including babies, women, sick people, civilians, innocent civilians were kidnapped from their homes. So to discuss if Israel is giving humanitarian aid or not, no, the pressure shouldn't be on Israel. The pressure needs to be on Hamas, on their allies in Qatar. That's where the pressure needs to be. And if we would have this discussion 70-something years ago, would people say, one second, are we giving the Nazis, are we giving them humanitarian aid? No, we don't talk about that. Let's talk about how do we help Israel win? How do we help these hostages to come back home? Several times I personally gave an order to cancel an attack in the past few months because we saw children around the target and we knew there are terrorists there. We're facing a cruel enemy which uses its own people and children as human shields, which every hospital and every school and every mosque and even every UN building we were in, there were terror facilities in it. That's what we're facing. So don't look for a proportional or even battlefield. We're facing a cruel enemy.
Yeah, the situation in Gaza is ongoing as Israel continues to eliminate Hamas, for total victory there. And I just want to encourage those of you who are listening today to remember to pray for what's going on in that area. But that's not the only place that Israel is facing threats. We've got a lot going on in the northern part of the country where I am right now here in Israel, and that is with Hezbollah. Right now, you've got a lot of troops up on the Israel-Lebanon border that are, you know, just taking care of business up there with Hezbollah. So just give us an assessment of the security situation here in the north.
As I said before, we were predicting war in 2023 facing Hezbollah, and this Iranian proxy has grown. It's not just in Lebanon. They're spread all over the place. We call it today the Northern Front. It's the Golan Heights Syrian border and the Lebanese border. And on the Lebanese side of the Hezbollah front, I can say that after the trauma of October 7, most of the towns were evacuated. More than 100,000 Israelis are right now, I have no other word than refugees. We have ghost towns. We have empty villages, and every day there's battles there. There's rockets, Hezbollah's shooting, there's missiles they're shooting. And we're not just sitting. Of course, we're attacking. We're making them pay a very heavy price. But we're more on a defensive mode there because we have a focus on what's happening in Gaza, and we want to finish the mission there. That's a decision made by our government and the high command. And I have my personal thoughts on that. But I will say that the question is not if. John, we've spoken about it before. The question is when. If we want these refugees to come back to their homes, then they won't come back with Hezbollah on the fences, which was the reality on October 6th and October 7th. And even if the Israeli government and army promise the locals, come back, it's safe, everyone remembers October 7th. And no one believes right now, unfortunately, our government or our army, if you like it or not. People are under trauma. And to push Hezbollah back will require a very aggressive military effort. It might happen in diplomatic ways. if we continue putting pressure on them, and if the international community also helps put pressure on Iran, maybe Hezbollah will be willing to pull back, understanding they're paying a very heavy price they don't want to pay. But that's also part of a military pressure that comes with diplomacy. The other option will be to go inside Lebanon and take care of it just like we're doing in Gaza. And I think Hamas underestimated our power on October 7. They thought because of inner conflicts in the Israeli society, we'll just give up. No, they're paying a very heavy price. It's going to happen in Lebanon sooner or later. I'll just move on to the Syrian front because that's, I think, something very interesting people are not aware of. We spoke in length about the 73 war. For 50 years, the Golan was very quiet. The communities were growing here. And John, I remind our listeners that on March 2011, a civil war broke out in Syria. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, these were our neighbors for quite a few years. And not one day of school was canceled in the Golan in those years. The approach of the people of the Golan is we continue moving forward. We don't look at the enemy, we look at ourselves. And my daughters did not know what a bomb shelter looks like. Since October 7, reality has changed here also in the Golan. Every week we have rockets. Just last week we had more than 100 rockets shot at 7 a.m., which is the time where the students are all standing, you know, getting on the buses to go to school. Yesterday, when I came home, my little daughter showed me how there was a siren because of a killer drone that invaded the border. So she showed me, it was very sweet, but also very terrifying. She showed me how they taught her in kindergarten, because there was no time to run to the bomb shelter, how they lied down on the floor and put their hands on the head. And they made it a game. But she doesn't understand what I understand. So our reality right now is rockets and drones and different attempts. The Iranians are trying to also bring us down. And I want to say something important. The people of Israel have resilience. There was a very big moral and strategic failure that was made in northern Israel, where a lot of regional councils said, we must evacuate. We're in danger. And the government was so petrified because of October 7 in Gaza that they allowed it to happen. And now they can't come back home. And just understand, Hezbollah every day is winning right now, because we're not in war officially. We're in battles every day. But you have ghost towns, as we spoke. And as the Golan leadership, we have made a strategic and moral decision. We are standing on our ground. Our community has very strong resilience. And we understand that we are sticking to our land no matter what. We will not evacuate the Golan Heights. And that is something that requires the government and the army to help us. It requires us also to look for partners who can help this effort, because our approach for many years is that we're not a confrontation line. Even though we had, as I said, Hezbollah and ISIS and Al-Qaeda, we said we're focused on life. So even legally now, different things that different communities benefit from, we don't. Legal status. So we're looking for partners in Israel and abroad in order to strengthen our preparedness for war. We understand, we love the IDF. We're part of the IDF. Our children and our family are in the IDF, and we can't rely just on it. We also have to be ready on our own. We've built emergency teams in every town. We're, with donations, purchasing equipment, drones and dogs, everything we need. The army, of course, is helping us. And we're not going to allow October 7 to happen here.
Let me ask you one other question about Hezbollah. How many rockets do they have? You know, you hear all kinds of things in the news. What is the ways that they can reach the state of Israel?
I'll go back to Gaza again. Every day we found rockets and destroyed them, and there was a huge feeling of satisfaction. And then you understand there's more, and there's more, and there's more. And when we started moving up north, the unit, we understood, we said, there it's going to be even worse. Hezbollah today has an arsenal of more than 150,000 missiles, including preceded guided munition. Israel has unbelievable defensive systems, the Iron Dome, you know, David's Arrow, other things. However, it won't be enough. We understand, I'm just going to talk about the Golan again. What the military told us when we entered office, they said, good luck, just so you understand. When there's going to be a full-scale war in Lebanon, we're going to have 7 to 10,000 rockets a day. Okay? That's what we understand we're going to. So that can maybe explain why the decision makers are very afraid to go into Lebanon. On the other hand, there is an approach that people understand what we're going to, but they say, let's do it. Because if we wait for 5-10 more years, it's not going to be 7,000 to 10,000 rockets a day. It's going to be 20,000, 30,000. It's not that they sit and wait. They keep on producing more and more and more rockets. And that's what we understand we're facing. And as I'm saying, as the regional council, our most immediate mission is to help the communities get more protection and more bomb shelters. I wish my first mission would be to bring more kindergartens and more playgrounds. That's going to happen in a few months. But right now, the emergency, the need is to be able to hold our people, because we said we want to stay here. We're not going to evacuate. But we need to make sure we're not endangering lives with that. So people will be in the bomb shelters for a few days. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be fun. But we're going
to
win.
What are some of the things that you would like to tell people who are listening right now about what's happening in Israel? People who love the state of Israel, love the Jewish people, and Christians who are listening right now who just are just so sickened by what has happened on October 7, and then now the ongoing war. I mean, this is not the first time that Israel has faced all of this. So what are the top two or three things that you would like to say to those people who are listening today?
First of all, I want to say thank you for the ongoing support. Definitely now you can't take it for granted. You're standing with what's right and you're standing with the truth. And you know, God sees everything. So that's first of all, thank you. The second thing is, you know, facts. Just keep on studying the facts, learning, just like listening to this show. You know, understand what's happening and be able to spread out the word. You know, 10% of the people, no matter what, are against Israel. And I think 10-20%, no matter what, understand who we are and are for us. There's 70-80% in the middle that don't really know, and they just see on the media something and build their opinion. You can show them the facts, show them what really is happening, and understand we're on the same side. Aside from that, pray. We need prayers. And of course, there's way to take action and help. There's amazing organizations that help and support the communities in Israel. And now, right now, more than anything, it's the emergency that we need help on. And there's ways to donate and help and be part of this holy effort.
Well, there's so many people who are listening right now, Christians who just love you as a Jewish person, and the fact that you know, you're with the Israeli Defense Forces, talking to Major Yaakov Sullivan. He is a reserve officer in the IDF. And again, I just want to encourage everybody and echo what he was saying to make sure that you are praying and just really standing with the state of Israel. I don't ever remember a time that you have faced so many threats at once. I mean, throughout the course of the history, you know, you faced a lot of threats. But at this very junction and this very moment, it's incredible what the state of Israel is facing. And you mentioned the people here in Israel and how they are feeling. And there seems to be such a somber spirit. Everybody I talk to here in Israel, as I travel, you know, around the country, they are very somber on what had happened, obviously, on October 7. And just like, we don't know what's next.
Yeah, it's we're facing turbulent times. It's hard to explain to my daughters what's happening. You know, I was away for more than 4 months. I was home very few times. They understand there's a war, but it's very frightening. I'll just say, all along history, you know, there was always resilience. We won when there was strong resilience and unity. And I'll just say the people here up north, here in the Golan, we have always been the frontier. And, you know, the second temple was destroyed only after the frontier in the north was brought down. And first the Romans went to Jerusalem. They failed. Then they understood they need to go to the frontier. They need to start from there. And there is an epic battle in a city called Gamla in the center of the Golan. And after Israel returned here, after Jewish sovereignty returned to the Golan in 1967, there was excavations in the ancient town, and they found a coin. And the coin had a menorah, the symbol of the menorah that was in the temple, and it said, for the redemption of Jerusalem the Holy, meaning the people here that lived here more than 1900 years ago, understood they're here for a purpose. There's a purpose. The frontier protects the heart. We're protecting Jerusalem. And I think now more than ever, we understand why are we here and what's our mission and what are we protecting. And when you have a purpose, you're stronger and you know you're gonna get to victory.
We're talking to Major Yaakov Sullivan. He's with the IDF as a reserve officer. And I want to ask you to step out of your reserve officer duties for just a moment. And I want to ask you about the pressure that Israel is facing from so many countries to kind of end the war in Gaza. You are facing pressure from the United States. You're facing pressure from other world leaders. How do you respond to that, or how do you feel about that? Or what's the right perspective on that as an Israeli, as a Jewish person?
We have no other option but to win this war and destroy Hamas, because if Hezbollah and Iran don't see that that's the price, if who messes with us, they'll do the same. And that's something I think people around the world need to understand, that for the average Israeli civilian, it's an existential matter. And now you need to choose which side of history are you on, the right side, or in a few decades, your grandchildren will study about what you studied as a child about what happened in the Holocaust. And you said, how come no one stood up? Now's the time.
There is so much going on here in the land of Israel. And Major, thank you so much for what you do. Thank you for your service to this country and all of the Israeli soldiers and what you are doing, because I really believe that it's not just Israel. It's the entire world, because you literally are standing in between these terrorists and what's in them getting to the rest of the world. So we want to say thank you on behalf of the United States and those who are listening today, those who love the Jewish people, because obviously you're fighting a battle between good and evil, and you're not doing it just for Israel. It's literally for the rest of the world. So thank you for your service. That's the Middle East Report. I'm John Riley, and I want to thank you for listening today. And I just want to remind you that you can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcast, or on all the major podcast platforms out there. So check that out. And you can also go to AFR.net and click on the podcast tab and then look for the Middle East Report. Please remember to pray for everything that is going on in the land of Israel. And it is a joy, and I say that with a heart of gratitude, to be here in the land of Israel during a time of war. It has been amazing to talk to so many beautiful Jewish people. Yes, they're going through a lot, but they also have a lot of hope as well. So it is just amazing to be here in this country during this time. Thank you for listening to the Middle East Report. I'm John Riley.